from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Depending on your point of view, jellyfish are either a threat, a thing of beauty, or an unimpressive sack of goo. But Julie Burwald fills us in and our otherwise transparent picture of jellyfish and their mysterious ways in her new book, Spineless, The Science of Jellyfish and the Art of Growing a Backbone. Among jellyfish's notable traits, they can age both forward and backward. They produce some of the world's deadliest toxins. And Julie Burwald joins us, and thank you for being with us.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, they are fascinating creatures, and, you know, the things that I've learned from your book are exciting to talk about. But let's talk about first what got you excited about jellyfish. This book is also a personal odyssey. I mean, of a science writer and going kind of from the academy into the natural world itself.
It's true. Yeah, I did have my PhD in ocean science, but then I kind of slipped off the academic track as I became a mom and a wife and moved to Central Texas, where I was landlocked. And I wrote textbooks for a long time. And then I kind of had the good fortune of being able to write a few popular science articles for, in this case, what got me into jellyfish was National Geographic. And I was actually, though, the story I was working on was one by Elizabeth Colbert, who's an amazing science writer. And she was working on a story about ocean acidification, which is, you know, along with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels, along with it warming our planet, it does another thing in the ocean, which is that carbon dioxide mixes with water and forms this weak acid, carbonic acid, and that's acidifying the ocean. And it's about 100 times more acidic than it was 100 years ago now. And this causes problems for animals with shells because that acid can dissolve shells, like the way Coca-Cola can dissolve our teeth. So National Geographic had put together this graphic, which was winners and losers in a future acidified ocean, and jellyfish were on the winner's side. And I thought, do we know that? Are we sure of that? And I dove into the scientific literature, and I found out there were a few studies, but not enough to know for sure. But what I also found was this super exciting scientific debate about what's happening to jellyfish in our oceans today, not just because of acidification, but because of all the things we're doing to the ocean.
Well, we've done shows with Elizabeth, and we've done shows on ocean acidification, and I think the listeners are pretty well attuned to these problems. And what's fascinating here is that jellyfish just keep on producing more and more.
I mean,
things are dying in the ocean, corals dying, everything,
right,
you know, and
right.
The jellyfish. So there may be something really important to learn there. And you do get into their importance just in the whole ecological and environmental realm. They are singularly important.
They are singularly important. And what's I found really interesting was that they had been so systematically understudied for the 20th century that we're sort of grasping at straws to understand exactly how important. And the reason why they were systematically understudied is because once we started studying the ocean using boats and nets and motors, things that move quickly, we destroyed the jellyfish on the way up. So we never even saw them. And our understanding of the ocean became biased towards durable, hard things. And so when we say, you know, what's happening with jellyfish today, we don't have a terrific baseline for where jellyfish were 100 years ago.
Or even a half billion years ago.
Yeah, that's true.
They are the oldest animal. I mean, there's some speculation about this, but probably the oldest animal on Earth.
Well, they're probably sponges are older, but they're the oldest swimmer on Earth. Yeah, oldest swimmer. So the first ones to get up off the seafloor and make a go of it.
They also, I mean, as I said in the introduction, they age forward and backward. I mean, this is fascinating beyond belief.
Truly.
If we could only do something along these lines, who knows what we could do for longevity and immortality and the rest of it.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, yeah, they're still trying to understand it, but the story is there's a jellyfish called Turritopsis, and it's a small, little, clear, I mean, the size of a pencil tip eraser, so it's very small. But jellyfish go through this life cycle where they're a little larva, and then they plant themselves as a polyp, which is kind of like a sea anemone, and it plants itself on a hard surface. And then that polyp kind of schisms itself into a stack of pancakes almost, and then the first pancake pops off, and that becomes a medusa. And then the next one becomes a medusa, and so forth down the stack.
And you give us a good lesson in your book about the myth of Medusa, too.
Yeah, well, that's a cool story. I talk about how she was misunderstood and how jellyfish have been misunderstood as well.
Well, they're misunderstood particularly because they're so venomous and toxic.
They are. And you can see how, you know, if you're naming a goddess after some, and your goddess has stinging tentacled hair or stinging hair and can turn you to stone, then a Medusa is a good likeness of that.
It's a certainly a good metaphor, an appropriate one. But this burgeoning of their population is also causing a lot of damage, as you go into in your book. I mean, getting clogged power plants, you're getting fisheries that are essentially closed off by jellyfish. I mean, lots of problems.
Yeah, lots of problems. When those polyps strobilate, you know, what I was talking about, the stack of pancakes, and one single polyp can become, you know, a dozen Medusa. And actually, a single polyp can also become a field of polyps. So when they all start going off at once, you have these giant blooms. And when those big blooms wash into shorelines, they collide with us. And if there happens to be a power plant there that uses seawater to cool its machinery, then it's like sucking in a million sink stoppers, and they have to halt operations. And that happens every year.
Causing millions of dollars a day.
Oh, yeah. And lost operation, you know, money for having to stop operations and clean out these inflow areas, and then haul off the dead jellyfish, which if you Google it, you'll see just like these giant containers like you see on the back of a train full of jellyfish that they have to haul away. And then, yeah, the same thing can happen where they get swept into aquaculture facilities, or fishermen just can't fish because their nets come up full of jellyfish.
We're talking to Julie Burwald. Her book is called Spineless, The Science or Jellyfish and the Art of Growing a Backbone. And she'll be tonight, 7 p.m. at Bookshop in Santa Cruz, and tomorrow, 7 p.m. at Stanford. And as long as we're talking about pancakes, jellyfish are edible and actually make, let's talk about it from a culinary standpoint. I mean, sashimi and all sorts of ways of at least preparing jellyfish to eat.
Yeah. I mean, so they can be served fresh. And actually, I've read that there's a restaurant in Monterey Bay that serves fresh jellyfish.
That's true.
And apparently they taste like a little better than an oyster, kind of briny
and
fresh.
They don't taste like chicken, like they say about rattlesnakes and all those other things.
Yeah. But they've been eaten for 1,000 years in Asia, and they, you know, because they're so watery, they're 95% water. You have to extract that water out somehow to preserve it in order to get it to a restaurant. So they kind of pickle it using salt and this other regular table salt, but also another salt called alum. And alum isn't so terrific for us. So you have to rinse. Once it's pickled, then you transport it wherever you need to transport it. But then you have to rinse all that alum out before you eat it. And then it's served as a salad. And it's, to me, it tasted like green pepper. I mean, it's real fresh tasting. It's all protein and high in antioxidants. But for Western menus, probably that alum is a problem. People may not want to eat jellyfish that have been preserved with alum. So there's all these foodie chefs in Italy who are trying to figure out new exciting ways to preserve jellyfish that don't use alum, like sous vide and, you know, deep freezing and all kinds of things. So we'll see. It could
are we supposed
become
to call them jellyfish or jellies, by the way?
I think they're not fish. But I don't get too hung up on that. I think it's just fun for people to learn the science, and I'm not going to get too hung up on nomenclature.
Well, your love of the science comes through in your prose. I mean, it's infectious in many ways. But I never thought of jellies or jellyfish, I must confess, as pets.
I don't think they should be, actually. I tried to raise jellyfish.
Oh, they were for you, yeah.
Yeah, I tried. I raised them in my dining room for, you know, a while. It was about as long as a carnival goldfish lasts. But it was great. I mean, it was really cool to be able to see them every day and try to. It's just really, they're so impressive. They're so transparent. And I got really fascinated by how they were transparent. They have these cool sense organs within the dips between the scallops of the bell. There's these really cool sense organs where they can actually, they can see. I mean, not like us, but they can tell light from dark, and they have a balance sensor like we have in our inner ear, and they have a touch plate that allows them to sense chemical signals in the water and currents. So it's like it's almost like they have 8 of these little faces around their whole bell looking out into the world and using that for information, to gather information.
And let's talk about the stinging, though, because those cells are about the fastest in the animal kingdom.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, the stinging cells of jellyfish fire with an acceleration of 5 million G's. And, if you just take and drop a pencil onto a table, that's 1 G. And if you watch a Ferrari accelerate,
We're
that's
talking about
three.
gravity here, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, gravity, acceleration of due to gravity, right. And so 1 G is, gravity, and then 3 G's is a Ferrari. And these things explode at 5 million G's. It's insane.
It gets beyond our consciousness, I think, even to imagine what that must be like. When you talk about translucency, there's kind of a whole continuum, isn't there? I mean, some of them are a lot more luminous and more, frankly, transparent than others.
Yeah. And you'll see some jellyfish are totally clear, and you can't the jellyfish pets I had were moon jellies, which are what you'll see in most aquaria. They have that kind of characteristic clover on the back of them, the four-leaf clover. But other jellyfish, like the giant jellyfish that I traveled to Japan to see, which weighs 500 pounds, which is like a refrigerator size. Yeah, I know. Is it's a real deep crimson color. And then the most expensive sort of commercial jellyfish in the world, its top is an aquamarine, gorgeous aquamarine color, and then its bottom is that deep crimson color. So yeah, they can also have camouflage that's pigmented.
We're talking with science writer Julie Burwald, and she's here talking about the mysteries of jellyfish in her book Spineless. And again, she'll be at Bookshop in Santa Cruz at 7 p.m. tonight and at Stanford tomorrow at 7 p.m. And she's here with us to answer any questions you might have about jellies or jellyfish or any comments you might have, perhaps of some encounters or some stings or whatever you may want to bring into the conversation. We do welcome your involvement, and let me tell you how you can join the program right now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you have questions about these mysterious and fascinating creatures, we do want to hear from you or comments. Again, feel free to join us. This is all about the science of jellyfish and the art of growing a backbone. We do welcome your calls. Again, it's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. So how about that backbone?
How about that? Yeah, I mean, the book is not just about jellyfish science, although there is a lot of it in there.
Like I said, it's about your odyssey as a
that's
science
right.
writer.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of a I had gotten out of academics when I started writing the book, and jellyfish were sort of a way back into that world for me. And they also kind of they gave me a way to, yeah, grow my own spine as a writer, as opposed to really a scientist. And it they've there so there's a storyline in there about how that happened to me. And then it also branches off into this idea that, we've really been spineless towards the health of our planet. And jellyfish are a way to talk about those things that we're drifting into, that we're just letting happen to us. And so the story is quite personal. I take you along with me, and I explain to you what I'm feeling as I travel through.
Can I ask you what science writers have been influential? Had great impact on you as a science writer?
Yeah, I think I met Rebecca Skloot in 2010, back when The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks had just come out.
Yeah.
And that book really did inspire me because it was story mixed with science. And I felt like I enjoyed having those two pieces come together. I enjoyed getting to know the author, the person telling me about the science, as I read her book.
Her
And
voice.
her voice, yeah, her voice and her story and what was happening to her. But I also liked the meat of the science in there. What is the story of cell culture? How does that affect us, and what are the ethical issues with it? So that was extremely influential to me as I started off.
And again, if you'd like to join us with any questions or comments, our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. Here's Gary, who writes, "Can the guest say anything about the jellyfish-like animal Velella? I had heard them called by the wind sailors because they had vertical structure that perhaps could help them move with surface winds. At one time, and possibly still, these beautiful animals would wash up the beaches of Marin County in enormous numbers."
That is a really cool question. So Velella are siphonophores, which is actually a colony of jellyfish. So you might have heard of the Portuguese man-o-war, and they're similar to that, where it's one organism, but it's made up of a colony of individual jellyfish that all decided to to work together. Well, evolutionarily came to work together. And you know what? About a year ago, you guys had that big blob hanging out here. There was a warm blob of ocean water that was hanging out on the California and Oregon coast. And the Velella were, I watched the news reports of Velella sweeping in, starting up in Washington State, and then just right down the coast. And everybody's like, we've never seen so many Velella before. And so that was about a year ago. And it went, and yeah, they seem to like the warm water and have come in, and came in with that blob of water. And it was really quite extraordinary to just follow the news reports of our beaches swarming with Velella and just watch that go down the whole Pacific coast here. They're really neat.
Can you talk a little bit? We'll get to our callers, a lot of calls coming in, but just about how jellyfish move through the water.
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories. Yeah, they, you know, they just have a band of muscle around the edge of their bell, and they squeeze that in to create a jet out the back. But it turns out that the margin, the edge, that sort of peplum around the edge of the jellyfish bell, it doesn't have any muscles. It doesn't do anything that requires energy. But just that the movement of that flap creates a wiggle along the whole bell. And the wiggle actually produces a low-pressure system in front of the jellyfish. And so the jellyfish sucks itself through the water just as much as it pushes like a jet out the back. In fact, probably more. And the scientists who told me that story, they're from Marine Biological Lab in Woods Hole, and they started looking around the animal kingdom, and what they noticed is that all animals in the water wiggle, and they do that, in fact, to produce a low pressure in front of the animal to suck it through the water. And we, who have created all these vehicles for the ocean, only think about pushing back because that's what we do on land. We create a high pressure system behind us to move forward. And we're probably wasting a ton of potential by not creating vehicles that wiggle and using that low pressure sucking.
A lot to say about the wiggle here.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's bring some callers in. We begin, William, with you. Good morning, William. You're on the air.
Hi. Morning. This is fascinating. I've always wanted to know what jellyfish do for nerves and muscles. I'm not sure they have exactly the same things that we do, and I've never been able to get an answer to that. So I heard your program. I was looking forward to being able to ask.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Jellyfish have a very simple nerve. They do have nerves, and they're very much like ours. They have what's called a nerve net. So it's kind of like a fine mesh. The guy who first described the jellyfish nerve net is named George Romanes, and he's from the 1880s. He was actually friends with Darwin, and he first mapped out the jellyfish nerve net, and he described it as fine muslin mesh. So it's kind of like a meshy system of nerves. There's actually more nerves around the edge of the bell, around where those sensory structures are, and around where the muscles that cause the jellyfish bell to squeeze tight.
They have nerves, but they have no brain, right?
Well, they don't really have a... No, they don't have a brain.
They have no blood.
They have no blood.
And they have no bones.
They have no bones. But they do have a sort of a distributed intelligence, I guess, is the way that I've come to think about it, because the nerve fibers are more dense around the edge of the bell, right where those sensory structures are. And if any one of those sensory structures receives danger, it can override the entire nervous system around the edge of the bell and tell the whole thing to turn on its escape mode and pump faster to get away. But one more thing about George Romanes is that while he didn't actually name the synapse, he predicted that it existed. And so, you know, by looking at jellyfish, he understood this really important thing about the way our nerves work.
Let me thank William for his call. Go right to another caller, and that's you, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I had a question about something called the box jellyfish. This is a very small and apparently very venomous jellyfish, I think in Australia. And I was just wondering, it's something like the size of a sugar cube. Is that true? And I'll take your comments off here.
All right, thanks for the question.
Yeah, so the box jellyfish are an entire group of jellyfish, and there's 50 different species.
Strictly down under. Yeah.
Well, not strictly. The box jellyfish as a group are distributed around the world, but mostly tropical. They are not all as venomous as the one your caller's talking about. So there's 50 species. So I don't want to malign all 50 species and say they're all totally toxic. But there are a few that are. There's this one that you're referring to that is extremely toxic, and it has been said to be able to kill a person in 3 minutes. So one of the most toxic venoms we know in the world, maybe the most.
Although there are some, I guess, who can kill a person in less than that, aren't there?
I'm not aware. Okay, yeah.
It's pretty fast on itself.
Yeah, right. I wouldn't want to run into it. But you know, there's another group of fox jellyfish in that same family that cause a thing called Irukandji syndrome, which is a terrible, terrible thing where you feel an impending sense of doom, and you don't want to get that either. But then there's other fox jellyfish that aren't toxic in that same way.
Here's Tom. Tom, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Well, yeah, thank you for putting me on. Years ago, my wife worked at Georgetown University for a biology professor who was researching jellyfish. We used to go up to the Chesapeake and rent a boat and go out and capture them from the Chesapeake Bay. Nowadays, he was looking at the application of the jellyfish toxin. Nowadays, one hears about jellyfish extract being used or being developed that is a either prevention or cure or delay for Alzheimer's disease. Could you comment on the current research and clinical application of jellyfish extracts?
Yeah, that commercial, well, first of all, the protein is that they are referring to in that product is something called green fluorescent protein, which did come out of jellyfish originally. Now it's made in bacteria. It's synthesized in bacteria. That protein is an extraordinary protein, and it's everything we've sort of learned about the way that cells works, not everything, but an enormous amount what we've learned about the way cells work come from the information that protein provides, because it glows when blue light is shined on it, it glows green. And so you can insert the code, the DNA code for that in front of the DNA of a gene you're interested in. And then when that gene is turned on, the animal will glow. So it's changed the way we understand cancer and Alzheimer's, all kinds of diseases. Now, the product, green fluorescent protein is a protein, and our stomachs are extremely good at breaking down proteins. We have proteases in there. It's very acidic. And so there's not evidence that that actually passes through your stomach lining into your bloodstream or through your blood-brain barrier. And the FDA is actually concerned about it and has filed a suit. So just be aware of it and you know, do some reading before you along the way.
And let me thank Tom for the call. We're talking again with science writer Julie Burwald, who's here in studio, talking about the mysteries of jellyfish and her book Spineless, and these fascinating aquatic creatures may be, after we're all gone, they're them or the cockroaches. I don't know that we've determined yet. Chris is on next. Chris, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Great. I love jellyfish, but I have a question. I was at Ocean Beach the other day, and oftentimes jellyfish wash up there, or what I assume are jellyfish. They're big globule jellyfish-looking things. My daughter had her fingers stuck all inside already. And I'm wondering, how toxic can that be? And also, if anyone knows what type of jellyfish those are that seem to show up on Ocean Beach a lot.
Well, if anybody does, let us know, and we'll try to get it in before we exit this segment. But some tips about concerns
Stinks.
About toxicity.
Yeah. Well, I can probably say that I'm not sure about Ocean Beach in particular, but here you'll get the moon jellyfish and you'll get sea nettles pretty often. So moon jellyfish are not big stingers. Sea nettles can be, and they can sting after they're dead. So you do want to be careful about that. One thing, the jellyfish scientists have recently come together. This actually happened post-publication of my book, and put out recommendations that if you are stung, the best thing to do is hot water and vinegar. So hot water and vinegar, that's a little PSA for everyone. and in terms of toxicity, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of species of jellyfish. So of the kind of normal jellyfish that would wash up on a beach that you would see, there's about 200 species that are known, but DNA analysis is showing us that there's probably twice as many. So all of those jellyfish have different toxins. There's one study I looked at where they looked at three different cnidaria, which is the group, the phylum that jellyfish are in. They found like 600 different proteins in the stinging cells, and only six of them overlapped. So it's a huge area of biochemical richness that we have not even started to understand.
Well, a lot of people interested in the medicinal or the scientific uses for humanity where jellyfish are concerned. I'm looking at a couple of emails and remarks here. For example, JD asks in a broad way, do you suspect jellyfish will continue to reveal benefits to humanity in each new generation that explores it? And a specific remark from Jennifer, who says, I read an article about Nora Ephron. She had been diagnosed with leukemia and wasn't doing well. While swimming in the Mediterranean, she was stung by a jellyfish, and the sting jolted her immune system such that she went into remission. So medicinal value, generally.
Wow, that's I hadn't heard that
story.
Either.
I knew Nora Ephron.
Really? Wow. Yeah, I mean, jellyfish are incredible healers. And actually, there's just a paper out, like, I think last month, about looking at jellyfish in terms of healing, because they heal extremely quickly. I mean, they're out there in the ocean, and you can think about their tentacles get nipped away by fish all the time. And when they heal, they don't scar. So they've started to look at jellyfish and how they lay down. There's like three levels of healing and how they initiate those processes as in order to find out more about our own healing. They're full of antioxidants, and they've been in Italy. They've also looked at jellyfish extracts as anti-cancer. So there are a lot of things we can still learn about health and jellyfish.
Gregory wants to know, how do jellyfish and coral interact? Do coral sting faster than jellyfish?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm not sure anyone's ever timed it, but they have, they're the same. They're in the same phylum. So if you think about it, a coral is a jellyfish standing on its head surrounded by a shell. And,
but they're all dying as opposed to the
jellyfish. Yeah, because of the, right, because their shells are dissolving. And the polyp stage of a jellyfish life cycle is like an anemone. Anemone's also in that group. And the thing that defines that group is the stinging cell. So they all have these stinging cells that apparently, I don't know if anyone's actually like done a
timed
race.
Them.
Yeah, between jellyfish, anemones, and corals.
But... Julie, we've got seconds left, but okay. Dale wants to know, are jellyfish a food source for sea turtles?
Indeed, yeah. All sea turtles eat them. Fish eat them. Lots of things eat them. More things eat them than we know.
Pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the book. And Julie Burwald's book, again, is out, and it's called Spineless. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I thank you for being a part of this morning's forum program. If all goes according to plan, we will be back with you on the morrow. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.